Thomas Ridd paints a picture by putting it plainly. We live in an age of disinformation. For a through line on this podcast, I will most often reference Russian disinformation, or desinformatsiya. We define disinformation in three main ways. One, this information is put out methodically. Two, content and sources may be doctored and online accounts may be inauthentic. And three, it's usually intended to weaken a target. In this case, that's us in the United States. The volume of information out there makes it extra hard to distinguish between fact and fiction. And my biggest question is, what is all this doing to us? You're listening to A Lot of Good People Told Me, and I'm your host, Alex Rose. Today, my guest is Eric Greenwald. Eric is a distinguished cybersecurity fellow with the Strauss Center. He previously served as senior director for cybersecurity on the National Security Council staff. And prior to that, he was with the FBI and U.S. Cyber Command. I initially pitched him an idea about a podcast that would explore the issue of informazione protivo-borstvo. And that is the Russian term for information confrontation that encompasses everything from information disruption in gray area conflict zones, as well as kinetic and cyberspace, as well as hacking and disinformation. So it's a pretty big topic. The more we got into these conversations about hacking and ransomware and all of this, we really realized it's so distinct from the issue of disinformation. So Eric was instrumental in helping me focus on one area. With my background in journalism and media and communications, we focused on disinformation and really looked at how people are falsifying narratives and spreading it for their own goals and interests. With his varied background and a lot of his work at that intersection of cybersecurity and journalism and world affairs, he has been such a great thought partner on this. Without further ado, here is my final conversation with Eric, the advisor. Hey, Eric, thank you so much for being here.
It is a pleasure.
So, Eric, what keeps you up at night about disinformation?
Well, I definitely don't use disinformation to help me fall asleep. I think what is endlessly frustrating to me is how effective disinformation is. And some of that is the people who are susceptible to disinformation are engaging maybe in a little bit of confirmation bias. Maybe they got a little conspiracy theory going, but it is not hard to design disinformation so that people eat it up with a spoon. And it gets me to the rather tired old phrase, which is, a lie has traveled halfway around the world before the truth has put its pants on. And sometimes the way I put it is the force of gravity is aligned towards lies. Gravity moves in the direction of lies rather than truth. And that's so sad to say, and it isn't always the case. But if that weren't true, then we simply wouldn't have the type of disinformation problem that we currently do.
Now, why is disinformation a cybersecurity issue? Or why is it a national security issue, for that matter?
Well, the national security issue is easiest to highlight when you think about disinformation related to an election or political questions that are under consideration by a particular country, by a particular populace or electorate. When it is possible for a domestic or a foreign force to have malign influence over those political processes by virtue of disinformation, it is my thought with respect to cybersecurity, the biggest way in which it is a cybersecurity concern is that when you have, for example, a social media platform, if it is not buttoned up from a cybersecurity perspective, it is much more vulnerable to being taken over or leveraged by bots who can use it to amplify their disinformation message in a way that they simply wouldn't be able to in the absence of being able to access those platforms in an illegitimate way.
I love that you actually talked about how bots can come and play into this. And most people listening probably know what a bot is, but for those that aren't familiar, can you just define what a bot is?
Sure. And I don't doubt there are going to be people out there who would quibble with my definition, which is going to be a bit imprecise. But a bot is essentially, instead of having an individual, real person who has a Facebook account or a Twitter handle and uses those accounts for purposes of delivering their own individual message, you may have an actor who pulls together hundreds, if not thousands, of accounts coming from different IP addresses that they are able to control usually in an automated way. So that they can, if they have a particular message that they want to deliver or reinforce, that with just a few clicks, all of a sudden what is, at least in practice, coming from a single person looks like hundreds, if not thousands, of voices simultaneously conveying the same message or reinforcing that message. And so it is a deception that can have a profound impact. Because it plays into people's perceptions, it plays into the algorithms of social media platforms, where when they see these thousands of apparently different people liking or repeating, retweeting these messages, well, then it starts bumping whatever that message is up to the top of its feed. And so it goes from being a microphone to a megaphone by virtue of an individual or a group that has figured out how to make themselves look like they are a horde rather than an individual.
We've talked a lot about how in this field there isn't really one silver bullet solution, but there are a number of small things that we can absolutely do to minimize disinformation. And one of those things that we ought to talk about, and I think you setting the groundwork with the bots is a good place to start, is sort of what should these big tech companies, these big social media companies, be doing? Some things that come to mind are, you know, better authentication and eliminating bots. I think that most people would agree that that's probably universally good to have real humans behind the accounts on social media. Not that that is an easy task, but that seems kind of like a no-brainer.
Well, let me say a general word before we get to any of the specific things that tech companies might do or might be required to do. In general, tech companies would prefer to do nothing. That's because it costs money to take the measures that you're talking about or others that people have proposed. So they're generally resistant to taking measures of any kind. There is some willingness, and some of that is driven by an understanding of, hey, our technology, this thing that we think is great, is being used in ways that is, to put it mildly, unfortunate. So yeah, let's figure out how we can make this as much as possible force for good rather than evil.
Yeah.
But that only goes up to a point, because the economics just don't really allow them to for example, find the gold-plated solution. That's not to say it's impossible, but the tech companies are not very eager to devote the resources necessary to actually root out the majority of what many of us see as a real problem.
So I want to pivot just slightly to just a short conversation on Section 230. Mm-hmm. So this has come up a lot along the way. Some are advocating for changing Section 230. Some are skeptical of changing it. They're a little worried if it's too easy to sue a social media company for their content. That just opens up a whole can of worms. So I wonder if you could just tell us first, really, what is Section 230 and what might be the argument for keeping it in place?
The best way I've seen Section 230 described is that if person A goes on Facebook and tells an outright lie about person B, person B could sue person A for defamation, for libel, for slander, but person B can't sue Facebook because of Section 230. Section 230 effectively provides Facebook with immunity for content that under other circumstances might expose them to liability. It is designed to allow tech platforms to do what they do, which is provide lots and lots of content to people without having to worry about being sued over that content.
I've got this example kind of bubbling in my head, and I don't know exactly what issues it illuminates, but maybe it's just all of the above. So Alex Jones, who is based in Austin, has been taken to court for his claims that Sandy Hook was a hoax. And he was able to legally say this because we have free speech in our country. As a proponent of free speech, how do I make peace with the fact that he is allowed to say that when it is so patently false?
Yeah, and I will say this before diving in, that I am not a First Amendment scholar, and my understanding of how the law works and my appreciation for the philosophy of the principle and how it works are not nearly so sophisticated as others who spend a lot more time focusing on this issue. But I come back to, I forget whether it was a Nathan Hale quote or somebody else. I disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. There's a lot of things that I love about this country, and one of them is the highly principled adherence to the freedom of speech. And you see this highlighted all the time when you look at the United States, even as compared to other Western democracies, where you have countries in Western Europe, for example, that are seriously liberal democracies, but that nevertheless have no problem with laws that would be completely and totally illegal inside the United, unconstitutional inside the United States because of their abridgment of free speech rights. And it presents real challenges from my perspective. I consider what Alex Jones was doing in particular with respect to Sandy Hook to be absolutely repugnant. I'm not very sad that he's been getting hit with pretty hefty lawsuits from families of Sandy Hook over the harm that his irresponsible statements have had on the families of victims from that horrific incident. I remember very well the movie, The People versus Larry Flint, which I thought was very, very compelling, in particular the statement towards the end that where Woody Harrelson as Larry Flint was saying, "I'm the worst there is. If the Constitution is there to protect me, then you know it's there to protect you." Problem is, Larry Flint was definitely not the worst that there is. And the Constitution is, in fact, there to protect everyone, even those who are the worst, obviously within certain limits. You know, it is the right to free speech is not absolute. It is a rock solid principle, but it is not absolute in its application. And we have numerous examples where the Supreme Court has determined that there are limits to free speech rights. But it is a foundational principle for this country, and it's one that I believe in firmly. But that is not to say I have no doubts and no struggles over how problematic that right can be when wielded by certain individuals.
One thing that has also come up a lot in almost every conversation I've had the last few months is this idea of civics education and media literacy. So civics education, really, I mean, the way that you just articulated First Amendment rights in this country, I don't think we had that class in public high school in Texas when I was growing up, where is that class? So do you think that civics education is, do you think it's possible? What age would you think is a good time to start it? How would we do that?
It's a great question, and I read an article recently about a country, I believe a Nordic country, though I can't recall, that has begun programs for kids at a pretty young age, helping them to understand and evaluate information that they see online, looking at it, inspecting the source, looking for other platforms on which to validate or question the information that they see. I don't have a definitive answer or even a strong opinion on the specific age or grade when civics education should start including information about social media and disinformation. But based on my own anecdotal experience with my own children, you know, I'm thinking probably fourth grade, probably after they turn 10, is a good place to at least get started. I've had some conversations with people about talking to kids on topics that are very difficult. And the principle that I have tried very hard to adhere to, and that is that you always tell them the truth, but in an age-appropriate context. And that may mean you leave out details. That may mean you try to explain it in a way that's going to be easier for someone at that age, a particular age, to understand. I think the earlier they get exposed to the concepts that they will need to grapple with later in life, the better.
Now, to bring up the subject of the week, the man of the hour, Elon Musk, he has tried to proclaim that Twitter is going to be the public square where we debate the most important issues of our time. Okay, I don't really want to live in a world where the only place we debate important issues is online. Is there a way to bring back town halls, or is there a way to move some of this heated political debate into a forum where there is dignity and humanity, and you're looking, at least on a video, at the face of the person that you're talking to about these issues? And even if you disagree, by the end of this disagreement or debate, there is some moment of catharsis where you recognize the humanity in the other person. I'm throwing this out there to you. Town halls.
Yeah. Well, before I turn to the specific question of town halls and the role that they might play, let me talk a bit about online forums and why they don't represent the epitome of social discourse. There are two things. First of all, people seem to enjoy, at a certain level, being enraged by others who have different views. And I've read at least one theory as to why the social media platforms that are specifically designated for folks from the far right don't seem to be succeeding. And that is, while there is certainly an opportunity for affinity groups to form, it's just not very interesting when everybody on a particular platform holds similar views, and that there is real appeal to the disagreement. And just as disinformation has its own force of gravity, I think conflict does too. And when people are able to be, if not anonymous online, at least not forced to confront others directly, that they feel empowered, entitled to be far more controversial and honestly cruel than they would be if there were some form of accountability. And so, turning to your question about town halls, I see tremendous value in having that kind of direct interpersonal contact in social discourse. But even in our today's social discourse in person, in town halls, you see the same sort of drama and conflict and, frankly, cruelty that is present in online discourse. And it would take somebody who has a better understanding of psychology than I have to say definitively whether the online discourse has infected our in-person discourse, but I think that's certainly plausible.
That was actually something that Chris Krebs and I talked about, utilizing disinformation well against your adversary. So one, you identify an issue. Two, you employ accounts to spread the message. Three, you amplify that content. Four, you get into the mainstream, so like TV. And then five, you get it into the real world through things like protests. And that's when it's been fully realized, with that goal to weaken or drive wedges and further divide. I think it's safe to say that there must be some correlation. And now whether those campaigns are coming from foreign adversaries or we are birthing them ourselves for fun here in the US, I think that your statement stands. I mean, a lot of these conversations have been happening in academia, which has made me really happy. And there are think tanks devoted to these kinds of things. So how do you think we can connect the dots between academia and the real world, quote unquote, think tanks, policymakers, everyday Americans? How do we take some of these good ideas out there?
I think that there is plenty to be gained by doing things in small steps and making change in incremental ways, seeing what sticks, seeing where we can make progress, and pushing forward in places where we see positive change. That can be anything from encouraging individual action to creating organizations, to getting philanthropists behind particular ideas, to pushing for legislation. Now, that last category, I think, is not only highly unlikely, but is generally not an effective mechanism for changing attitudes. There may be ways, I've been using the analogy of the force of gravity. There sometimes are ways in which legislation can alter the force of gravity, and in this case, the force of gravity towards disinformation. I have not seen any legislative ideas that I think that would have a really positive impact in that respect. I don't rule it out, but to me, that's on the list of possible solutions. That seems to me to be the most implausible and practical. It is interesting because I think if you look at the debate over Section 230, you have a little bit of a microcosm of the broader philosophical problem. There are a lot of people out there who say, oh, if we change Section 230, the problem is going to go away. Well, no, because the problem is that there are people out there who have a lot of hate in their hearts and don't have a problem purveying it in social discourse. And there are now technology platforms that make it possible for those people to amplify their message, whether by virtue of coming together in affinity groups or by virtue of getting the megaphone effect from the algorithms or, as we've discussed, use of bots to try to artificially elevate the message. And those things won't go away if we change Section 230. They will still be there. There will still be technology that enables them to amplify their message. And even if there weren't, it's always been the case that those messages of negativity, disinformation, are easier to amplify than the truth, than statements of reason and calm. And so I would discourage anyone from looking at something like reforming Section 230 or other measures as, the possible solution to the problem. They won't be. And it gets back to the notion of big steps or small steps. I don't think there's a magic bullet. I don't think that there's anything that can, with one fell swoop or several swoops, really change the course of what's happening in our social discourse. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen through incremental change, through individual action, through ideas that are too powerful to be overwhelmed by disinformation and hate.
Well, on that note, I will just say a huge thank you, Eric, for your insight and your time and all the brain power you've put forth onto this project.
Oh, thank you very much. And thank you for working on this project. It really has been a pleasure. And frankly, I have learned a lot from the work that you've done and, more importantly, the conversations that you and I have had.
Likewise. Yeah. Thank you so much. A Lot of Good People Told Me is produced and hosted by me, Alex Rose, a graduate Brumley Fellow at the Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas at Austin. The music you hear was composed by Alex Dupree, who also edited every episode and served as a crucial production partner. For more information, please visit alexrosebb.com or strausscenter.org. You can also follow us on Instagram at A Lot of Good People Told Me. Thanks for listening.